This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm speaking to Professor Emeritus John Brown of Glasgow University, and he's been working on predicting whether comets that go very close to the Sun will survive their journey. So the first thing I thought I'd ask you is, how do you actually observe these comets when they get so very close to the Sun and it's so bright?
Yeah, well, we've been seeing them approaching the Sun for several decades, actually, but when they get in within about two or three solar radii, they get possibly fainter than the corona, so it becomes very difficult. And hadn't been done until July last year, and Carol Shriver and his team at JIPTA, Lockheed Martin in California, I don't know exactly how he did it, but just around the same time as I had been thinking of the theory of these things, he did some careful detective work and managed to make an astonishing movie of a comet. I can't remember what it's called now. It's got a long string of numbers, quite a small one, scooting in through the corona. And he has a nice movie. It's on the internet with a kind of a circular window around it to draw the eye. And it was done by looking in the ultraviolet with the Solar Dynamics Observatory in space, so you have the advantage of no sunlight, there's no scatter light. And it was I think the main movie was done in an ultraviolet wavelength of about 170 angstroms or so. So that helped to pick it out against the background. And that plus a very careful search in the right places, sending a movie of it just fading out in the Sun, in the lower corona, actually.
So these comets you refer to as snowballs in the title of the talk.
That's what they are. I mein, they come from this Oort cloud or somewhere far out in the solar system, and they're made of frozen ices and dust and so on. I think they've got a density of about roughly half that of water, so they're quite fairly loose, dusty snowballs. And you know, this all goes back to the early ideas. So there was the dirty snowball and the icy mud ball and things like that. That's basically Fred Whipple from Harvard. He was the pioneer of a lot of this, and he proposed the dusty snowball concept and so on. And that's what happens when there are snowballs approaching the Sun, and they progressively vaporise.
How do they end up visiting the inner solar system in the first place?
Well, these ones that we see are mostly mostly Kreutz group comets, but there's various group comets. And these original, what they call primordial comets, they come from extremely far out from the solar system, almost out to the nearest star in huge circular orbits. And they go round and round there with hugely long periods. And now and again, a star nearby disturbs the cloud a bit, and some of these, their orbit gets disturbed and they start to fall in towards the Sun. Now that's a normal long period comet. Hale-Bopp would probably be in that category. But sometimes these comets come in and they get so close to the Sun, or possibly Jupiter, that they get torn apart. The tides raised by the planet tear them apart, and they end up breaking up into a huge long string of many small fragments. And we think that most of these sunrasers that we see belong to a group, or groups, including the Kreutz group. So you get a string of them in almost the same orbit. And when I first ever heard of them in the 70s through the 80s, it was thought they should be very, very rare.
Because they don't live very long, I guess.
I think just to think they would be that. Well, possibly that any that had come close would have been wiped out before, I suppose. That's what you're saying. And however, it turns out it's actually about in the region of 3 weeks. The patch, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, but at least 1 week, I would say. So they're really quite common things. And these are all fragments of the same giant comet from the past.
Right. And then when they come in and they approach the Sun, I guess the key part of your talk is that up to now it's been difficult to know whether the comet was going to be completely vaporised or whether it would survive. And I actually remember one of the recent ones where people were talking about it a lot, Comet Lovejoy, whether it was going to, as it passed the Sun, come out the other side or not. And you were able to say something about whether it would. And
Well, I tried to wager with my colleagues who were all working on this on the internet. Tried to get a decent, I'm not a betting man, but I decided to gamble on a bet that it would make it. Nobody really won, actually. Nobody took me up on it. It did actually come out the other side, but it turns out, I heard just last week it came out the other side, but it no longer had a head, it was just a tail. So it was almost wiped out. But I couldn't have said for sure. It's more the opposite way around. If it comes out, you can work out how heavy it must have been. Because the heavier it is, the better its chance of surviving. So by seeing when it dies or whether it dies, you can actually figure out the masses of comets, which is useful.
I see. And how do you model whether comets will survive?
Well, it depends. If you're it turns out it's a really critical point, according to my modelling at least. If you come in with what they call a perihelion point, the closest point on the orbit to the Sun, if that is bigger than about 1% above of the Sun's radius, above the surface, so it's a tiniest fraction. If you skim, I call that a Sun skimmer, if you come in just above that, then the atmosphere doesn't really do much to the nucleus. It's just the sunlight that vaporizes it. So, and whether they survive or not depends on their mass. Any that go significantly lower than that, and we haven't seen any for sure yet, I call them Sun plungers or Sun plummeters, and they get into a denser part of the lower atmosphere. And because the way the Sun's atmosphere is, it's got the density of the Sun's atmosphere goes up very quickly as you go deeper. And once you get in there, you're more or less done for. You're not going to get back out. And every time they travel another few hundred kilometres, the density is a factor of 3 or something higher. And the ones in the corona, they vaporise reasonably slowly, you know, like maybe an hour, half an hour.
So the corona is extremely hot, but
thin. It comes to that point, it's very thin. The corona, in the corona, they vaporise only due to sunlight, I'll explain why. Once they go deeper, sunlight becomes irrelevant, and it's the friction of the atmosphere, which can be enormous. Actually, if you could get near to the surface of the so-called surface of the Sun, the photosphere, down there, the heating by the friction is just what makes the shuttle heat shield glow. That kind of friction is 100,000 times more intense than the sunlight once you get really deep. So that's terminal. In the corona, there's been some silly misunderstandings in some of the stuff on the internet about Lovejoy. People saying Lovejoy miraculously survives the 2 million degree corona. Mm-hmm. And that's just wrong. The hot corona has nothing to do with it. As you just said, the corona, although it's at 2 million degrees, is very tenuous. And I figured out, if I got the sums right, if you were to put on your kind of reflective jumpsuit to protect you from the sunlight, sort of bright white, perfectly reflecting, and just lie there, the warmth you'd feel from the hot corona is only about the same as a sunny day in Manchester.
Really?
It's almost exactly about a kilowatt per square metre of your body, and it would take about a year to vaporise it from it. So it's not that does it, it's nothing to do with that, it's the sunlight. Patrick Moore's very strong on this. If anyone talks about the corona being hot, he says, yes, well, it has a very high temperature, but it doesn't have any heat.
So it can't get things into thermal equilibrium.
It's just so tenuous, it's hot particles, but there's so few of them touching you, you don't really feel it.
Okay.
So the comet doesn't feel it very much either. So the corona could be much hotter, but it still wouldn't make much difference.
And do you learn something about the Sun when you observe these comets, or do you mainly learn about the composition of the comet?
Well, in principle, we can learn both. At the moment, we're just starting to try and do each of these things. But the thing that got me very excited is if the comet plummeted or whatever, especially in the case where it goes deep and explodes, what you actually get is a whole comet exploding like what they call a flash spectrum. And if you had good observations of that, in principle, you could maybe study the chemical composition of the whole comet. I mean, everything we've done so far, like Deep Impact and others, it's just been touching the surface. We don't know what's inside, really. So that potentially very good. Also about the strength of comets, the masses of comets. But we've also seen, especially with Lovejoy and the July 2011 comet, that they pass through the atmosphere and with a fairly straight tail just running behind, as usually happens to the comet, and suddenly this tail whips and lashes around, and it looks as if it's happening as the comet runs through probably a strongly magnetic part of the corona. So we've now got comets as probes of the Sun's atmosphere. That's why I'm giving a talk today to the solar session, because there's potentially really maybe a whole new way of doing solar atmospheric physics as well as cometary physics.
Okay. And I guess the last thing I thought I'd ask you is, these comets, have they been around in their present form for a long time before they make their journey into the Sun?
The big ones that come from way, way out, like Hale-Watch, I think it, I don't know how many, tens or hundreds of thousands of years. I think the group comets tend to be somewhat shorter periods, maybe, let's just guess, say, less than 10,000. So they've been around for a while. The only thing is, I mean, I'm very, very keen, because I'm the first person who's worked out at all the theory of the kind of impact of the explosion ones, and I really, for obviously, I'd like to see some. But most of them may already have gone. You know, if they go that deep, they're going to be destroyed for sure. So if they've been around more than once, that's it. It's all over. So to see those, we'd really depend on the orbit being a bigger orbit being disturbed to go a bit deeper into the Sun. They've all been around for quite some time, but not as old as the solar system.
Right, I see. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, pleasure.